Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors. Today on The Prosecutors, we continue our investigation into the mysterious death of Ray Rivera. And welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, with my exquisite co-host, Alice.
Exquisite? Well, that was really good.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't think that's an apt description, because I just told you before we started recording that I was eating a bag of chocolate chips out of the bag.
I think that's beautiful. That's absolutely exquisite. What are you talking about? Why waste your time baking them into cookies
exactly.
When you can just eat them straight up?
let me go get a stick of butter. Anyways, it's really good to be here
anyway,
with you.
Yes, it's always good to be with you guys. Always a pleasure to join you. This is the highlight of our day. Definitely the best part of our day.
Today is, especially today, it's the best part. Today, I think
especially
100%
today.
Of the people I talked to today lied to me, I think. My witnesses.
I think that's right.
I think so.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know how that makes me feel about, humanity, but...
I feel like I'm getting better and better at figuring out when people are lying to me. I don't know. I'm always surprised, though, so maybe not. I'm just a gullible person. I believe people when they
You're
tell
me. You're not gullible. You believe the best in people, and shouldn't we all do that?
I do. That's probably not a great trait for a prosecutor.
It's a terrible trait for a prosecutor and a lawyer in general.
Yeah.
All right,
we're
quitting.
Really just believe the worst about people always, and that's the best way to never get screwed over. So that's my piece of advice for you today, kids.
Also a terrible
life
path. Anyways, we're here actually to talk about Ray Rivera.
Yeah, we're here to talk about Ray Rivera. Yesterday, we went through sort of the general arc of the story, went through the timeline of the days leading up to Ray Rivera's death. We'll be coming back to that again and again, just because I think that's really critical to what happened here. Whether you think Ray was murdered or whether you think Ray committed suicide, I think those days tell the story. So we'll get more into that. But now that we've told you sort of the overarching story, we want to dive in to the specifics. We want to get into a lot of those details that we sort of just, flew over in this 30,000 foot view that we were giving you of what happened to Ray Rivera. So I think we'll start today with a little bit more on Mr. Porter Stansberry.
And really, Porter's name is kind of the undercurrent throughout this entire story. Porter is the reason that Ray and his wife move out across the country to Baltimore. It's the company that Ray's working at. Porter comes back from out of town the day that Ray's reported missing. He puts up a reward. He's looking for his lifelong friend. But then, once Ray is found, it's really interesting. You heard from last time that Agora and Stansberry lawyer up and they issue a gag order to all their employees. That also applies to Stansberry. Stansberry never speaks about what happens to Ray, despite Ray being one of his longest, closest friends.
And Alice, can you explain to people a little bit? Because I think a lot of people probably don't understand how that works. Because I think a lot of people think if the police show up at your door or at your company and they say, hey, we've got questions for you about this thing that happened, that you have to talk to them. But that doesn't seem to be what happened here. So can you walk the folks through a little bit how that would work?
Sure. I mean, you don't have to speak to anyone, right? If the police come to you and ask you a question, you really don't have to answer. They can subpoena you to, say, a grand jury where you have to come. But once you're there, you can actually plead the Fifth. You've probably heard that before, and that's your Fifth Amendment right not to testify against yourself. And you don't have to say anything incriminating if you do not want to. You have that right under our Constitution.
Let's say you wanted to talk to somebody at Agora and you subpoenaed them to the grand jury and they're not a target, so you're not going to indict them. You don't think they did anything criminal. Can they still invoke their Fifth Amendment right if what they would say is not going to incriminate them? Does that make sense?
That's a really good question. So I think especially when it comes to Agora, they also have some protections for like confidential business dealings. There are statutes and regulations that that protect them that may have nothing to do with incriminating evidence, but they may not have to reveal certain confidential business dealings if they're not the target, right? You have to subpoena, if you're subpoenaed for records because you're in a criminal investigation, you have to turn them over, but it doesn't mean you have to testify about it necessarily.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing because it's sort of striking, I think, and particularly for folks who aren't that well-versed in the criminal justice system, that a group of people and a company could essentially just stymie an investigation by saying, nah, we're not going to talk to you. We're not going to talk to you at all. We're not going to tell you anything. I think that would surprise most people.
And I think most people don't know that they don't have to talk, right? I actually am pretty surprised that, you know, we often do witness interviews in our job, and for the most part, almost all the time, when we call up someone or we show up at someone's door to talk to them, they talk to us. And I'm not always sure it's the best idea for them.
Look, I think people would be surprised at how many of the cases we prosecute have incriminating statements made by the defendants. I would say the vast majority. I'm always, whenever I have a case and the guy immediately stops talking and says he wants a lawyer, I automatically think, man, this is going to be a tough one, you know, because it's just, it's so rare to actually have that.
Absolutely. And here's the other thing. Let's say you get subpoenaed to grand jury or you get subpoenaed even to a trial to be a witness. You are not called to the stand to just start talking. You're not allowed to say, give a narrative. And not that you're not allowed. You aren't asked to just give a narrative. You aren't given a microphone and the lawyer says, tell us everything. That's not how it works. What happens is the attorney has to ask you questions and all you have to do is answer those questions. Now, if you wanted to be sneaky, you really just answer the specific question before you, right? So it would be like, did you eat a strawberry on Monday? No. But I ate a strawberry on Tuesday. I don't have to answer that question. I don't have to tell you I ate a strawberry on Tuesday because you're answering the question specifically before you. And so even if you're being asked questions, by answering a very specific question before you, you may not actually be giving the whole story. And that's why, you know, questioning a witness, directing a witness or crossing a witness is really an art form that you have to learn over time. So back to Porter Stansberry. We've already told you that he was a pizza delivery guy after college, then found incredible success with Agora, and he became a multimillionaire. And in August of 2006, not long after Ray disappeared, he purchased a $1.5 million home in a really fancy Baltimore suburb.
You know, and I think the thing that's so, I mean, look, it's great that Stansberry has had success. I'm glad he has himself a home / you know, mansion in Baltimore. But I think it's like, you know, your friend dies in May or whatever, right? And you're buying your mansion in August. You're just moving on with your life. And yet you never, you know, with all that money, you could have hired a private investigator, right? Like if you don't think Ray killed himself, or even if you do think Ray killed himself, you could hire yourself a private investigator. You could get to the bottom of what happened here. You could help Allison, you could talk about your friend, and yet he doesn't do any of those things. You know, look, I get it. I'm sure his lawyers told him, you need to stay as far away from this as you can, and we're going to talk about in just a second why he might have done that, because this wasn't the only legal thing that was going on in his life. But it's just such a bad look. It's such a bad look for somebody who has all these resources and just decides, you know, I'm not going to use them on this guy that I've called my best friend, on this guy that I got to move across the country, you know, to help me in my business. It's just, I don't know. It's sleazy.
You know, this is a different time, but, you know, oftentimes, say on my Facebook feed, if something tragic happens to a friend of a friend, like let's say a young father, you know, passes away and leaves behind three young children and a wife, and the person is a friend of a friend of a friend on Facebook, I will almost always see someone have started a GoFundMe to help the widow, to help the kids, to help pay for funeral costs, you know, things like that. That's really common. And here, you know, Stansberry has all these resources. He didn't even have to start a GoFundMe, you know. He could really fund it himself, and yet there's just radio silence.
And there's been, as far as I know, and feel free to reach out and correct us if we're wrong, and we'll certainly apologize to Mr. Stansberry, but as far as I know, he's never really talked about this. And, you know, once Ray died, that was it. He moved on. So, I don't know. But look, it wasn't the only thing going on for Stansberry when it came to legal troubles at the time. So let's talk a little bit about Pirate Investors, which is a great name. You can tell it was born in those heady days of the late 90s, early 2000s, when people considered themselves pirates of the Dow Jones, and everybody was on Raging Bull talking about the next great penny stock they were going to make a fortune on. And this is really a great example. I would characterize it as a pump and dump scheme. I'm sure Stansberry would disagree with that, but I don't know that the SEC would. So Stansberry's got this company. It's called Pirate Investors. It works underneath Agora. He's sending out this newsletter, and it presents itself as this investment club that's going to offer insider investment advice to outsiders. They're going to do the things that mainstream investment firms don't do. And frankly, from their point of view, things that mainstream investment firms don't want the little guy to know about. They're telling all the secrets. And one of the things that they promise is that on occasion, investors, if they are willing to pay, you know, a little fee, they'll get a special tip. So, you know, you pay a few hundred dollars up front, and you're going to make thousands on the back end. And in May of 2002, Pirate Investors sends out an email to thousands of its subscribers. And I actually think this is the Oxford Club that they send this super insider tip to. And the email says that there's a nuclear energy company that is going to benefit from an arms reduction treaty between the United States and Russia. And Pirate Investors, under the signature of Stansberry, claims to have an executive in the company who's going to provide inside information on when the big deal will close. And for a mere $1,000, Pirate Investors will share the date of that deal to their subscribers. And you can imagine why this is so valuable. You buy the company now, you wait till that date, boom. Stock goes up, you sell, you make a ton of money. And all that for just $1,000.
Hey, really quick, Brett. I know we're about to head into their legal troubles, but how is that legal? If for an insider to tell you when a deal is going to... That's insider trading, isn't it?
I think... You know, insider trading has always confused me. This is not something I'm an expert on. So if somebody out there is an expert on insider trading, I think because nobody at Pirate Investors is an insider, and nobody who's receiving the information is an insider, they can do this.
But insider trading is just trading stocks based on access to confidential information. So if they're reporting on someone's confidential information, I think it's insider trading.
See, I think it goes beyond that. I think there has to be some sort of connection to the... I don't think it's enough that you have insider information. Like I said, I just don't know a lot about this, but I don't think it's enough. I think you have to have some sort of duty to somebody that you're violating in order to get hit for insider trading. Like I said, if there's somebody out there who knows a lot about this.
So we're going down a rabbit trail, but all I'm saying is This doesn't sound super legit to me anyways.
No, it's going to raise, I mean, look, yeah, this was going, red flags were going to shoot up all over the place as soon as they did this. I mean, I can't imagine that the SEC wouldn't look into this and would want to know, who is this insider who's sharing all this information to you? And did they benefit? And various other things. But yeah, I would love to, if anybody knows that, answer that. I mean, this is the thing about lawyers. We're all, we're like anybody else, right? Like you ask a brain surgeon about the foot and they're not going to know what they're not going to tell you. Same thing with lawyers. I don't know anything about insider trading. So if anybody does, let us know. But in any event, they got this information and the company, and this is actually, this is really interesting. And you don't, you got to dig to find out this information. This ends in an SEC complaint. I pulled the complaint. We're going to put it on the website so you can read all about this. Also pulled some court decisions related to this case. You can read those as well. But the company was USEC, and it's US for a reason, because it's the United States Enrichment Corporation. And when they say United States, it's not just some fancy marketing tool. It is actually the United States of America's Enrichment Corporation. So it's a government entity that was owned by the United States until its privatization in 1998. So you can imagine this is basically a business organization that enrichment, it's not enriching the mind or the soul, it's enriching uranium. So this is a company that worked with the Department of Energy, who you may recall as being the bad guys in Stranger Things, to produce enriched uranium. Uranium-235.
What do we use enriched uranium for, Brett?
And what do we use enriched uranium for? It's glow-in-the-dark clocks, right? No, no.
Definitely
It's the element that is necessary to fuel nuclear power plants and is used for the enrichment of plutonium and the construction of atomic weapons. So it's a very important element. And according to pirate investors, yes, the atom bomb, USEC was due to make a deal with a company called 10X. Now, 10X, what in the world does that name mean? Well, I don't know what it means because it's a Russian word. This is a Russian governmental corporation tasked with dismantling nuclear warheads. And Pirate claimed that they were going to turn around and sell to USEC the materials from those nuclear warheads. And 10X, you know, if you know anything about the Soviets and you know anything about the, you know, they had all these very sort of blandly named things like the Small Machine Corporation, right? And the Small Machine Corporation was the corporation that made like atomic weapons and stuff like that, right? Like, it's not very big. And if you've ever watched, or if you watched Chernobyl, you would have heard about a lot of these different entities. And 10X was one of them. For a very long time, it had been illegal for the Russians and the Americans to trade in uranium for obvious reasons. But according to Stansberry, on May 22nd, 2002, there was going to be a deal approved that was going to coincide with a summit between George W. Bush and Vladimir Putin. And this was the tip that they were giving to their very best investor clients for only $1,000.
This sounds, of course Russia would be involved.
Of course Russia's involved. I know, seriously. And as you can imagine, this has fueled a lot of speculation for many years afterwards. But here's the problem. The tip goes out on May 14th, 2002. And before that day, USEC was averaging a trading volume of about 189,000 shares a day, right? So not a lot of shares. This was not a company a lot of people were interested in. After May 14th, after this tip goes out, trading averaged 3,340,000 shares a day. So we went from 189,000 to 3,340,000 shares a day.
Gosh.
More, an increase of more than 3,100,000 shares. Yeah, I don't even know what the percentages are.
A lot of percentages.
A lot of percentage increase.
Thousands of percentage.
And the price increased from $7.85 a share to $10 a share on May the 20th. But here's the problem. May 22nd comes and May 22nd goes and there is no agreement. And of course, what immediately happens is the shares for this company, USEC, fall 15% on that day alone. Now, one thing that is interesting, this deal did eventually get done. And so you wonder if Stansberry actually did have inside information. But it was not done until June 19th. And in fact, it wasn't until 2008 that the Russians and the Americans actually entered into an agreement to allow exportation of nuclear material from Russia to the U.S. But Stansberry was right that a deal was in the works, and it did happen, but it happened too late to benefit his investors. And that hurt a lot of people. Over 1,200 people had paid the $1,000 for that tip. And when the tip flopped, some people were unhappy. And they not only asked for their money back, they complained to the SEC. And the SEC was more than happy to listen to this very bizarre, seemingly illegal, as Alice pointed out, scheme that Stansberry had going. And on August 1st, 2007, so this SEC files a complaint in August 1st, 2007. So a little over a year after Ray's death, Agora and Stansberry are ordered to disgorge $1.3 million in profits and pay some substantial fines. And they fought this judgment all the way through the Fourth Circuit, where they lost, and to the Supreme Court. They actually were able to get a large number of publishing companies. And we're talking, you know, the most famous publishers in the country, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, a lot of different people, to file an amicus brief for their petition for certiorari. So the Supreme Court doesn't have to take any cases. If they didn't want to take any cases next year, they wouldn't have to take them. They get to pick, right? And so a lot of times you'll file your appeal, what we call a petition for the writ of certiorari. Why we call it that, I don't know.
Latin.
Fancy legal term. Latin term. Yeah. Somebody probably knows what all that means. I don't know what it means. Don't care. So you file your petition, and then all these people can file these amicus briefs. Amicus?
Yeah, it's friend of the court.
Anyway, so you got all these people filing these briefs for the court saying, you should take this case because this is really important. And Stansberry's argument was, you have a right to be wrong, right? So he said, look, I thought this was right. This wasn't fraud. I believed the story was true, and that's why I published it. Now, the SEC's position was, no, you never thought it was true. It was pure fraud. I actually think the SEC was probably wrong about that. I think Stansberry did believe this was going to happen.
Yeah.
Because you talk about a huge – he thought, and he actually – and there's some documents from the company that said this, where he was like, look, if we get this right, man, we can charge a fortune for the next tip, right? So $1,000 may sound like a lot. But if they nail this, it's going to make their company. So I don't think the guy was lying. I think he had a tip. But the Fourth Circuit didn't believe that, and the SEC didn't believe it, and the Supreme Court did deny their final petition in 2010.
This is the funny part. It is really expensive to litigate something all the way up to the Supreme Court, probably about $1 million. And so it's, I mean, $1.3 million is really not that much for Agora. Maybe it's a lot for pirate
investors. They spent more money fighting it.
Yeah. Definitely spent more money fighting it. Maybe it's on principle, but you also have to think your name is being dragged through the media and the legal world in a very bad way for a very long time, because lawsuits take forever, especially if they're going up through the appeals courts all the way to the Supreme Court. It can take years, as this one did. It took 3 years.
Right. This is the thing that eventually I decided I didn't want to do private litigation, because we had some cases with some big companies where they were very upfront with us that they didn't care anything about the fine they were facing. They just didn't want any bad publicity. So they were willing to pay us more to fight it than they were to just settle and pay the fine or whatever. And that just didn't inspire me to get up and go to work every day, right? I am fighting so this company doesn't have 2 days of bad news. But anyway, yeah. It's just not an uncommon thing to do, where you really are spending more money than's at stake just so you can claim victory.
Right. So following this USCC debacle, Stansberry, like many companies, decides to rebrand, and now he is calling his company Stansberry and Associates before he goes to Stansberry Research. And as you know, it's this company that Ray and Allison move across the country to work at. Like we've already told you, Ray is a really creative guy. He likes to write. He knows nothing about investing, but he still thinks he can handle this position. And this is where he writes the Rebound Report.
And it's crazy to think about that in 2002, you know, all this happens in 2002, and they're this debacle with USCC. You know, they're facing this SEC complaint, and they're changing their name to try and sort of distance themselves from this. And then what do? They turn around and hire a guy to write a newsletter about investing, and he doesn't know anything about it.
Maybe this goes to their point that you can be wrong. He couldn't have known. He's just a writer.
Yeah, there you go. What did he know? He is, you know, honest mistake. This guy didn't know anything about investing.
Honest mistake. So we've told you a lot about Stansbury and Associates or pirate investors. What's really interesting is the parent company. Brett, tell us about Agora.
Yes. They now call themselves the Agora.
Oh,
so it's even more fancy. I guess the Agora was the marketplace in Athens. I think that's right. Or I'm making that up. I'm not sure. But Agora was founded by a man named Bill Bonner. It's a private company, so it's hard to know exactly how much money they make, but it's about a $500 million a year company is what I was able to find. So that's a $500 million. That's a lot, but it's not that much, you know, in the grand scheme of things. They're based in Baltimore. They own like all the nice old buildings in Baltimore, which I thought was interesting given how much money they make. And they consist, it's sort of an interesting business model. And we talked about this a little bit yesterday. It's a plant 1,000 flowers and see which ones bloom. So they've got these 30 essentially independent subsidiaries that work underneath their umbrella. Pirate Investors / Stansbury & Associates, that's one of their little subsidiaries. And Stansbury, I mean, it's his company and he has a lot of freedom to run it how he wants, but he's also under this Agora umbrella. You know, if you think about like a franchise, so if you own your own Taco Bell, it's your Taco Bell and you're running your Taco Bell how you want to, but you're part of the Taco Bell, you know, empire or whatnot. It publishes books. It publishes newsletters. I kind of wonder how the newsletter business is going these days. I don't really know how they've transitioned in the internet age, but they do it on every conceivable topic. They're targeted towards consumers with a more conservative bent, I think you could say, both wealthy consumers, people who want to be wealthy, you know, people who, when I was in college, I used to get cigar aficionado, right? Not because I could afford anything in cigar aficionado, but just because it was cool and it made me feel cool to read about these fancy cigars that I would never be able to afford, right?
You did that as a college student?
Oh, yeah.
Were you like 80
Absolutely.
As a college student?
Like everybody, no, whatever, man. Cigars were awesome back then. I don't know if they're still awesome or not. But anyway, it's like Garden and Gun, you know, like that magazine. I mean, I don't know why people...
That is a great
I don't know why
magazine
people
name.
Actually get it, but it's an awesome magazine, right? It looks good on your coffee table. So they publish those kinds of things. But they also, you know, Mike Huckabee, Rush Limbaugh fans. I mean, those are the kind of people who are really going into this. Folks who don't really buy what they're hearing from the mainstream, who think of themselves as sort of aligned against the entrenched interest. You know, people who don't like the swamp or whatever you want to call it, the deep state. Like, all that sort of stuff really plays into the Agora and the stuff that they're doing. And in true Agora fashion, Bill Bonner has his own newsletter that he publishes, and it's called Bill Bonner's Diary. And there was an interesting entry in one of those that I think, I don't know, for me, it raises questions, because if it's accurate, I think it tells us something. I'll always believe, and we're going to talk about this in a little while, that Agora knows more than they're letting on. And I think this might be a hint of that. So in one of those entries a few years after Ray died, Bonner, he's complaining about the media and the fake news and how they twist everything. And in doing that, he's talking about how the media covers Agora. And he describes the death of an employee who can only be Ray Rivera. The entry is mostly a complaint about the media, but there's one line that I thought was interesting. We'll talk about it more later. He says, quote, "In one sad instance, an ex-employee committed suicide distraught over a personal problem." What exactly that means, I don't know. But like I said, as we get towards our theories and what we think happened here, we'll return to that.
So let's talk about, we mentioned this before, but Ray was not very good with his own money and he had a lot of debts, right? So let's put them all together. He had the $280,000 mortgage on their home, but you know, the payments for the mortgage was actually less than the rent they were paying in LA, since LA is incredibly expensive to live in. They just had a wedding in Puerto Rico a few months previous. That couldn't have been cheap. Beautiful wedding. And
on the beach, all that jazz.
On the beach, sunset. And they were still newlyweds, right? He had just moved across the country to work at this company, and he was just a writer. It's not like he had some executive position. And then there was the credit card debt. They had $90,000 in credit card debt, including the $70,000 advance for the video. So it's fair to say that the majority of their credit card debt was actually taken out to make this video for Stansberry.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of credit card debt. The $70,000, obviously, yeah, it's an advance for the video, so you think you're going to pay it off. I think the other $20,000 goes to what you were saying, sort of the wedding. You know, you've got to think that in the
maybe
move.
Maybe the move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've sort of exhausted their savings or whatnot. I got to think that that's some stress, right? I mean, credit card debt in particular is pernicious. The interest rates are really high. It can be very difficult to pay that off. So we don't actually, we, you know, we obviously don't know all of their finances or everything that was going on there. Maybe that wasn't a big deal. Maybe they had plans to pay it off. But I thought it was interesting, at least, that they did have those debts that they had incurred pretty close to when Ray died. So one thing I think that's very interesting, you start talking about Ray's death, and you start talking about the day of his death. You start thinking, what are some ways we can figure out what happened? And I think everybody's mind immediately goes to, look, if you're in a hotel in 2006, there's going to be cameras. You know, there's going to be cameras. Did Ray walk in with anybody? Did he get in the elevator with anybody? Did cameras catch him alone? Well, here's the problem. There were cameras in the Belvedere, and for the most part, they worked. But they didn't work on the day that Ray died. So the Belvedere Hotel, and according to media reports at the time, the Belvedere Hotel security cameras had, quote unquote, malfunctioned. The police took the video anyway before eventually returning it to the hotel, at which point Allison was actually able to view this video. And according to Allison and reports about what she saw, it shows activity up until that day, May 16th, the day that Ray goes missing and presumably dies, and then it's gone. And inexplicably, it jumps from the 15th to the 17th, and it's like the 16th, it just never happened. And some people speculated it's like it was deleted.
What? So both sides of the day had recordings?
That's my understanding. My understanding is that everything is fine up until the 16th. The 16th is gone, and then it's back. That's my understanding of what the video looks like.
What are the odds?
Yeah.
Because at first I thought it was just that the camera didn't work, you know, and it's like, okay, that camera didn't work. But what? What if the 15th and the 17th showed up, but not the 16th?
And this information I'm taking from Makita Brotman's book. So if anybody can correct that, I mean, I know on the Unsolved Mysteries episode, they talk about the video not working. But her book makes it sound a lot more suspicious than that. It's not just that it wasn't working. It's that it wasn't working on that day. Now, the rooftop cameras were disconnected. So, you know, I think they probably just were never on. But the other cameras, yeah, it seems like it worked, it didn't work, and then it worked again.
Whew. Okay. One last unusual aspect before we move on to some angles we have from our prosecutor perspective. Allison had given Ray a money clip as a gift. I think it may have been even like a wedding gift, but it was very special to him. It was precious to him. He loved Allison. He loved this present. He really never went anywhere without this money clip. And it was a distinctive one. It had engravings. It's one of a kind. And yet, even though Ray's body was found and, you know, his phone and his glasses were found near his body, the clip wasn't on his body, and in fact, it's never been found. So they recovered his car. They searched all in his car. Nowhere. It's not at home. Where else could it be, right? Ray was at home, and then he was in his car, and then, assuming, he goes up to the Belvedere and jumps. So where is his money clip? And it's never been recovered. And that's just kind of a weird aspect. You know, it may mean nothing, but it might mean something. It might mean that someone has it.
Yeah. I mean, it is a weird, it's just a weird thing, right? The money clip's a weird thing. It's a weird thing. And it was something that was personal to him. It was something that was special to him.
But, you know, my one thought is the money clip probably was just not a money clip, right? It probably had money in it or a credit card. And if, in fact, your theory previously that when he hit the roof, the items in his pocket fell out, like his glasses and his cell phone, maybe the money clip did fall out, but it fell maybe off the roof and fell onto the street, and someone thinking it was just a dropped wallet with cash or something picked it up and took it.
That's a possibility. Or could have fallen into a drain or, like, you know, into some sort of crevice where nobody ever saw it again. Those are all possibilities. My mind kind of goes to the bad noir hitman who takes something special to the victim back to the guy who would send him out to kill him, you know. But I think it is more likely that something along the lines of what you were describing is probably what happened.
We talked about this last time. Ray's cause of death was listed as undetermined by the medical examiner. This is a double-edged sword, right? Because they can't determine that it's a suicide, but they also can't determine that it's a homicide. And in Baltimore, you probably know this, there's a lot of crime and there are a lot of homicides in Baltimore. The police force there is overstretched and it already has its hands full of homicides. And honestly, it just doesn't have the capacity or the resources to worry about the undetermined cases. So just administratively, it helps them not to have another homicide case that goes unsolved, right? Because they are open cases on their docket. The police wanted a straight suicide ruling, and that's not what the medical examiner gave them. So even though the police decide it's a suicide, you know, maybe is that based on evidence that we just don't have access to? Do they have more evidence that they haven't released? That's kind of confusing to me, though, because you typically hold back evidence if it has to do with a crime. Suicide is not a crime. So why would they hold back evidence, right?
The Baltimore police have said that the reason they think it's suicide is based on the evidence, right? The monolithic evidence. But they've never really told us what that evidence is. Now, we're going to talk about some potential evidence for suicide, but I don't think you can say any of it's so conclusive that you wouldn't want to at least look into the possibility. My understanding is the medical examiner went undetermined because there were just wounds that she did not feel comfortable calling the result of suicide, particularly some on Ray's legs that looked as though, I think like his shins, it was damage that she could not really explain.
The way the bone was protruding, it looked more like a beating rather than a fall.
Right.
Right. And it wasn't consistent with with the other injuries
right.
that he had. And here's the interesting thing, you know, maybe the suicide ruling is based on evidence we don't have, or maybe it's based on complete lack of evidence and the police just wanting to close the case. And, you know, would Allison actually have been better off if the case had been determined a suicide? Maybe in that situation, because it's not a pending, you know, homicide investigation, maybe she could get more information that's currently unavailable.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say, right? Because even though it's undetermined, it is an open pending investigation. So I think all those limitations we've talked about before apply here with equal force.
All right, and we've already touched about this, about Agora and its Russian connection, or potential Russian connection through the Pirate Investors Company. There is an international conspiracy aspect to this, right? You see, Agora has a mysterious sense to it, and the lawsuits against it, its property all over the country, and its seeming connections around the world have led some people to believe that Ray might have been assassinated because he knew too much. Still, despite all the conspiracy theories online about Agora, no one has pointed to any concrete evidence of Agora's massive influence. And I find that really interesting that in the Unsolved Mysteries Netflix version, I don't think they ever even say the name Agora
in
the Ray Rivera episode.
I don't think they do.
And that's kind of a huge omission, especially since the day he disappears, he gets a call from Agora. As we said, Agora is a successful company, but it's not a huge conglomerate by any stretch. And its main connection to Russia actually blew up when Porter's tip fell through, right? So if there is an Agora connection, it honestly might be just more mundane than some grand conspiracy. Rather, it's probably more possible that Ray became the target of someone who lost money because of the publishing company and took it out on Ray rather than some massive international conspiracy of a Russian assassin.
If there's one person who believes the Gora is sort of this, you know, all-powerful conspiracy company, it's Allison. According to Makita Brotman in her book, when she talked to Allison, you know, Allison didn't want to talk on the phone. She wanted to speak in person. She didn't trust phones. She thought that Agora might be listening. And she tells this story. It's a very strange story. And so I'm actually going to read it to you from Makita Brotman's book, An Unexplained Death. So this is something that Allison told her. Allison says there was a time when she decided she wanted to write a book about Ray. So she joined a memoir writing group. At their first meeting, the teacher, an older gentleman, went around the class asking everyone what they planned to write about. When it was Allison's turn to speak, she said that she was going to write about her husband, who had been murdered in mysterious circumstances while he was working for a financial organization in Baltimore. After she had finished speaking, says Allison, the teacher asked her whether she would mind staying behind at the end of the class. When they were alone, he wrote something on a piece of paper, folded it in half, and handed it to her. Then he told her to open the piece of paper, look at what he had written, and tell him whether those were the people who killed her husband. Allison opened the piece of paper and saw the words, Stansberry/Agora. For a moment, she was struck completely dumb. When she could speak, she asked the teacher how he knew. He told her he used to be a lawyer and his work involved prosecuting white-collar criminals. He knew the kinds of things those people could do. He said others had spent years trying to prosecute those people, but could not even get close. His advice to Allison was to stay away. If she wrote her story, he said, she would be putting her life on the line. So, yeah.
So she does believe this conspiracy.
So I don't know if we're all going to be, I don't know, Allison, if we're going to be assassinated for publishing this, this podcast. But I just want to note for anyone who might be listening right now, we do not think Agora is involved. Yeah. So like we said at the beginning of this episode, this is a story that's, you know, it's a lot deeper than you think when you're first looking at it. Even though it is mysterious, I think there's not a lot of evidence and you kind of feel like, oh, a guy jumps off a building. But in reality, you know, there's just so much more going on here. We're going to stop for today, but we got so much more to talk about. Next time, it's going to be next week. Sorry, guys. You know, thought about doing 3 episodes in 1 week, but that would kind of kill us. We literally would probably die if we had to record 3 episodes.
Not that we don't love y'all. It's just a lot.
We love you so much that we don't want to die so we can continue doing this for you. So we're going to do that. We're going to publish that one next week. And we're going to talk about our theories. And we're going to talk about other people's theories and theories that are popular out there on the internet. And one thing we're going to do that I think you'll find very interesting is read through this note that was taped to the back of Ray's computer and was found there sometime after he died. You probably heard about that note if you know anything about this story. Definitely talked about it on Unsolved Mysteries. But one thing we want to do is really go into it and read it to you, at least to the extent we have it, so you have an understanding of just how strange that note is, and then talk a little bit about whether or not that gives us any indication of what was going on in this case. You guys know how to get in touch with us at Prosecutors Pod for Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Shoot us those emails at prosecutorspod@gmail.com. Comments, questions, concerns. Been getting a lot of great recommendations from you guys. I mean, Ray Rivera was a recommendation from a listener, and we were going to do this case even if it hadn't became sort of the hot thing with Unsolved Mysteries.
But it pushed it up in our timeline to do it because you guys absolutely recommended it.
Yeah. And then prosecutorspodcast.com is our website where we will have some documents we talked about today regarding that lawsuit that Agora was involved in. Also want to recommend, should be obvious by now, given how many times we've mentioned it, but An Unexplained Death by Makita Brotman. A lot of the stuff that we've talked about comes from that book. It's a very well-written book. She spent a lot of time researching this case. There's a lot of stuff in there that goes way beyond the Unsolved Mysteries episode. Like I said, it also kind of goes off the rails sometimes. I really like that. It may annoy you, but just fight through. is my recommendation because it's a good book.
We've tried to cut down the off the rails part and stay with Ray Rivera. So if you want to just listen to us, that's fine too.
Right. Fewer stories about how rats are really good and people shouldn't hate them so much. And more Ray Rivera. But Alice, it's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed this. Look forward to getting back with you next week and finishing up this story.
Absolutely. And I can't wait for next time because I really want to get to the end of this.
I know. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors.
All right.
Okay. You're amazing.
We're both amazing. Podcast amazing.
Pod-mazing.
Pod-mazing. You sound tired.
I'm not tired.
You're great.
I'm not. Sorry. I'm sorry that you feel that way.
Is this our first pod fight?
It is. Pod fight.
Pod fight.
Pod rumble.
Pod rumble.
Okay. Anyways. Talked to Dwayne today. We can talk about that later.
I want to hear about it.
I kind of think Dwayne didn't do it, but I don't know. He's from Canada. People from Canada don't murder people.
No, but people flee to Canada.